This is the Kona Edge, the home of Ironman triathletes who dream of qualifying for the World Championships on the Big Island.
Welcome back to yet another edition of the Kona Edge. It's awesome to have you with us, and another great story to share with you today. Before I get into Jeff Fafar's story, thank you for listening. Lots of great feedback again last week from Kathy Winkler's story. They keep coming, emails and tweets and Facebook messages, keep them coming. Just look for the Kona Edge online on social media. You can also email me, brad@thekonaedge.com. But without further ado, let's get straight into today's podcast. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Jeff Fafar onto the show. Welcome on to this edition of the Kona Edge. We head to Mississippi now, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Jeff Fafar onto the podcast. Jeff, welcome. Nice to touch base.
Hey, Brad. How are you doing? Thanks for having me on.
Oh, most welcome, Jeff. You've got a fascinating story, and I can't wait to share it with our listeners today. And funnily enough, I chat to a lot of teachers on the Kona Edge. I was starting to think that in order to qualify for the Big Island, you needed to be a teacher. But you're the second pilot I'm speaking to, so I'm starting to think there might be something in being pilots.
Yeah, so it's... perhaps, I don't know. It's definitely the pilot job has very unique work hours compared to other people. So it definitely does allow us some time to train.
Cool. Well, Jeff, I'm gonna touch on that in a moment, because that does, I think, is some unique challenges to your situation. But let's take a step back and look at your journey into the sport of triathlon. Where did your sort of love for the sport emanate from?
Sure. So I moved to northern Mississippi, just outside of the Memphis metropolitan area, back in late 2005, after I got hired with FedEx here in Memphis. And didn't have any kind of an endurance background. I never really swam or biked, had done just a little bit of casual running up to that point. And my wife was working at a gym that had a indoor triathlon. And so she came home and told me about it. And I decided, oh, that kind of sounds like something to kill some time, and decided I'd start training for that. At first I really couldn't even swim, you know, down and back in a 25-yard pool to start. The indoor try, it was, you did a 500-yard swim in the pool, then you ran across the gym and hopped on one of their stationary bikes and did 12 miles on that bike. And then you ran and hopped on a treadmill and did a 2-mile run on the treadmill. And, so you really didn't need any, equipment for the most part. It was really easy. I did that and I was kind of instantly hooked. I just said, man, I want to go get a bike and try to do one of these for real.
It's a big step up from an indoor triathlon in a gym to an Ironman. How long was that progression? Talk to me about going from that to your first Ironman.
Sure. Yeah. So I think I was pretty smart about the way I went about it. So in 2006, I did that indoor triathlon. I believe it was in, it was either February or March of that year. And so in 2006, I did 4 sprint triathlons, and that was it for the first year. I'd done a bunch of little running races and stuff, but kind of got into it slow. In 2009, I did my first half Ironman or half distance at the Gulf Coast Triathlon down in Florida, and did quite a few other sprints and Olympics that year. And then finally in 2008, I took my first crack at the Ironman and did Ironman Florida.
So that's quite a stretch between starting out in the sport and sort of just finding your feet to your first Ironman. Would you advise that for new triathletes?
I think especially so if you're really new to a lot of the sport. Like I said, for myself, I had run a marathon prior to getting into triathlon, but it was really quite casual. I think that first marathon, I was thinking, oh, if I could break 4 hours, that would be great. And I think I might have done did a 4:15 or something like that. So I was not fast by any means, and I wouldn't have called myself an endurance athlete at all. So, and then with the swimming and the biking being completely new, kind of gaining that race experience and just taking it slowly and over time, I think was really, really beneficial. And I learned a lot of really good lessons along the way that allowed me to continue progress and I think probably avoid getting hurt and really, really enjoy the sport along the way to where I've, you know, 12 years later, I'm still just as passionate about it now as I was back then.
Because that is often the case, isn't it? That someone jumps into it really gung ho and they end up doing an Ironman or two or three even in their first year and they stick around for a couple of years and then you never see them again. It's going in that way. It's easy to pick up and get burnt out, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I do think you'll see that. Sorry about that. One of my dogs is barking.
No, no worries.
I think that, you know, the unfortunate part of the triathlon world right now is for the bulk of the population, especially that's doesn't have exposure to it, is they really see triathlon. And you know, if you tell anyone, hey, I do triathlons, and they say, oh, you know, they immediately think of Ironman, and that's all they know. They don't really know about short course. And for me, actually... when you look at, I've done 7 Ironmans now over 12 seasons, I think it was, since 2006, and 3 of them were in 1 year. So I tend to actually spread out my Ironmans quite a fair bit.
I find that really interesting because I chat to a lot of athletes and particularly the good ones are very much A-type personalities and it's go, go, go the whole time. The strategy for spreading them out that much. What's the thinking behind that, Jeff?
So a good part of it is the specific training for Ironman is, I mean, it if you want to do well, there is a certain extent of volume that's mixed in there, and it takes a lot of time. I'm married. My wife races triathlon as well, and we have a my son's going to be 10 coming up shortly this year. And so I think racing Ironman year in, year out just takes a lot of time. But more so for me is I'm not a very small guy either. I'm typically race between 170 to 180 pounds. And I think doing a lot of Ironmans just beats me up because I as the A-type, I do race a lot. We'll see. I believe Kona next year will probably – I might work it out so it will be my 100th triathlon. So I've only done – it'll be my eighth Ironman, but my 100th triathlon.
Oh, that's brilliant. I think that's fantastic. Jim, when did Kona get onto to the radar? I mean, was that just also a natural progression? I mean, from your first one, when did you think, you know what, this World Championship thing sounds cool?
I think – it was, I had met a bunch of local triathletes when I first got started. And, you know, everybody starts talking about the Ironman. At first, I was thinking, there's absolutely no way. I mean, I just, whoever wants to go that far must just be, you know, crazy. And I remember training that first year going out for we had a large group that first Ironman I did that were training for it. And the first time we did a 70-mile ride and then a 90-mile ride and a 100-mile ride, I mean, I just thought this is ludicrous. You know, I don't know who would really want to do this. And I'd always had, I was like, oh man, going to Kona would be incredible. But it seemed so, so far off. When I went to go do Florida that year, so I actually progressed to where I think if I would have had a really, really good day, I would have been somewhere between like a 9:55 to 10:15. Is what I originally hoped for that very first one, which is still remarkably good in the grand scheme of things. But it's still for that time at Florida, it would probably have been about 50 minutes off of what I'd need to do to qualify for Kona at Florida. So it wasn't, although it was fast, it wasn't, it was really hard to see where I would find that next step at that point.
That, I think, for a lot of people is the thing that, really holds them back with getting to Kona is when you go as hard as you can, particularly in your first one or two, and you go fairly fast, and then you look at the slots that were taken in your age group, and you think to yourself, there is no ways. Where am I going to get that time from? Where did you, I mean, when you went back and sort of analyzed that race and targeted Kona, where did you think you could make up more time, and where did you make up more time?
Well, 2008 in Florida became a very interesting experience. So to start with that, there was a group of us that went out to have lunch the day before at a sandwich shop. And out of it, a large number of us got sick. I was the only one actually racing, but I got food poisoning quite badly. So I ended up actually finishing the race in a little over 12 hours and 20 minutes. And spent over an hour not moving on my bike. I actually fell asleep on the side of the road. I had just a really, really rough time, and it was really remarkable to get through it. And the funny thing was that it was very inspiring, because by the end of the race, and I realized, wow, I was going to finish this thing, I was elated just across the finish line, where I think had I had a normal day, not have gotten sick, and say maybe I crossed the line at 10:20, I might have been absolutely crushed in my head that I missed my target. But when I ended up getting really, really sick with the food poisoning, it became a whole different thing. It was, especially since it was my first one, I really, really wanted to see if I could at least do it, even though I was sick. And when I showed up on the swim start that morning, I thought there was no way I was going to even reach the finish line. So That was an experience that was unique because of that. But then when I did look at what the guys did that qualified, and I saw how far out I still was, you know, I figured I had a really, really long way to go. So I really just spent the next couple years training and racing a lot of sprints, and I did some halves along the way. I did a couple of ITU World Championships, with age group world championships for sprint and Olympic distance. And all that time, I would find either somebody in my local community or somebody else who I knew was just a little faster than me. And it may not be getting to the podium, but I was just trying to see if I could beat that person consistently for a race or two. And then once I could beat them, then I'd find the next person and the next person, and the next person. Before I knew it, at least in these local races, I was starting to compete for the overall win in these small local races. And I found I was getting faster and faster. And so about in the 2012 timeframe, I started thinking, wow, if I really focused and put everything together, I might actually be able to try and qualify to get to Kona. And that's kind of when really 2012 was when the idea started that I may try to see if I can get there.
Jeff, do you think racing those shorter, faster ones at the high intensity have had a big impact on your speed over the longer distance? And the point I'm trying to get to is, do you think that's a mistake that some triathletes make, that struggle to qualify, that to get to that time, so they try and just race more Ironmans harder, as opposed to going back and working on their speed, as opposed to just trying to race long and hard the whole time?
I think it could be. I think racing Ironman has a unique skill set in its own right. And the problem with it is, regardless of your training days, there's pretty unique things that happen over, you know, a 9 to, you know, 11 hour period for some of the older age groups, maybe even 12 hours, that you really just can't duplicate in training. So I think you do have to get out and race some of them to see that. But I do agree with you. I think when if somebody thinks, oh, I'm trying to qualify for Kona, and for whatever reason they miss, they have a bad day, they have a mechanical, just something's off, or unfortunately now it's getting so hard to qualify, especially for a lot of the really young or the older age groups, and most of the women's age group, you almost have to win to get a Kona spot. So even if you have a good race and just somebody faster showed up, you know, a lot of people, I think, say, well, I'll go try to do whatever the next one I can get in. And before you know it, they've done 3-4 Ironmans in a year, and you throw 2 or 3 years of those together, and that's a lot of specific training that it misses a lot of fast training.
Yeah, and it's so, also the cumulative effect of that. I mean, it's one thing doing three or four Ironmans in a year, but it's a totally different story racing three or four in a year.
Absolutely, for sure. And I think probably the difference between a lot of age groupers that don't maybe have a long athletic age in the sport, they do have some kind of background in sport, so they, you know, haven't necessarily just come from nothing, where I didn't have any endurance background, so it took me a really long time to develop, and it's hard to go fast and go long at the same time. You know, it's the chances of doing it successfully are pretty poor, and the chances of breaking down you know, dramatically go up. So I think if you're trying to learn to go fast, you almost have to stay shorter. And then once you can get fast, then you can progress that into staying fast for longer.
Yeah, some of us battle to go long and fast generally. So it's interesting to hear. I'm not the only one who struggles with that. Jeff, let's talk about your situation, and particularly from a training perspective. It's one thing talking about the races, but you've got a fairly unique sort of work situation, that you're a pilot, you fly lots, and how you sort of fit your training in is quite interesting. You mentioned to me before we started the recording that managing fatigue and sleep is probably one of your biggest challenges. Tell me a little bit about your work situation and how you manage to fit training in between your flights.
For sure. Yeah, so with the way the FedEx system works, we do a large amount of our flying in the middle of the night. So I may be showing up down in the lobby of a hotel at 7 or 8 in the evening, flying much of the night, and then getting back to a hotel lobby at, 5 or 6 in the morning somewhere. And there'll typically be a break somewhere there in the middle of the night where I can get about an hour and a half or 2 hour nap. So yeah, it's really, you know, I get to a hotel, sleep, and then, I mean, I guess it's very similar to anybody else. It's just my hours are kind of different. The very unique part of training on the road, running is not too bad. You can typically run just about anywhere. Swimming, I just have to prepare beforehand and look and see where the pools are. I have a membership with a local YMCA, and luckily we stay in downtowns of most of all our cities, so there's almost always a YMCA within reach of where we're staying. So I can typically find a pool to swim in, since hotel pools are far too small to do any real training. But the other thing I have used with it is I have a swim tether, which is, you know, basically a belt with a rubber band that you hook to the side of a pool. So if I just have a 10 meter long hotel pool, I'll just strap myself to the pool and swim in place.
It's funny you say that, because Chris Montross, who we've spoken to on the podcast before, who's also a pilot, that's how he does his swim training. So if this is the first time you listen to this podcast, that might sound quite strange to you, but you're not the only one who does it, Jeff.
No, and it's kind of a last resort for me, because if you ever thought that running on a treadmill or sitting on a bike trainer is painful, try just staring at the bottom of a pool and not moving. It's a unique experience, but I mean, it will do if I have to. And then finally, the last one is the cycling. So when I trained for that very first Ironman, I did a 5 hour ride on a upright hotel stationary bike. And it was brutal, you know, but I've done quite a bit on weird hotel bikes here and there. But in the end of 2012, I ended up buying a folding bike made by a company out in Oregon, and it's actually quite a nice bike. It's not like the Bromptons that, you know, you see people riding around town on with three gears, or even a single speed and a flat bar. It's actually the geometry of a real road bike with drop handlebars and everything, and but it all folds up into a standard suitcase. It's got 20-inch wheels, and now I've ridden all over the country on that thing, and I do a lot of my training on that. So
I guess it all just boils down to planning and making sure you're prepared. And even though you're traveling a lot and you're training in different locations, it's pretty much the same for anyone that if you're going to get a good solid week's training in, you've got to fit it in around your life and make do with what you've got.
And that's really, I think, the biggest thing is you know, I skip out on maybe going out to restaurants or going out to the bars with my crew or something like that. I mean, I just I have different priorities and I make sure, you know, the funny thing is I have found that sometimes on a trip, it is easier to fit in the training without interruptions than it is at home. Because if I'm at a hotel, I basically just have to worry about, you know, sleeping, eating and training and making sure that I'm prepared to go to work. Where at home, you know, you've got all your honeydews and playing with your son and doing 8,000 other, there's always something you could do that could distract you and eat up time before you know it. So it actually could sometimes be easier to train on the road.
It's a good point you make there too, because there's also the guilt factor when you're home. And it's the,
sure,
like, I could spend 4 or 5 hours out on the bike, or I could be at home with the family. And that is something I think a lot of age groupers grapple with.
For certain. You know, one of the things I've done over the years, and I think I did my first training camp was in 2010. I went out to Boulder for a week with Endurance Corner. And one of the things they do is they set up this training environment for the camp where you show up and everything's kind of planned out. You know, all the training rides, all the nutrition, all of the food. And they highly encourage that you know, if you can just clear out your life stress so that you can just show up, you'll be able to put in some pretty decent training. And your body can absorb a ton when you remove just normal life stress. So, like you said, putting a really big week at home can be sometimes challenging, not because of the lack of time, but because of the huge amount of distractions.
Mm. Talk to me about the sleep, because that's quite an interesting one. And you've obviously been doing this for a while, so your body is probably accustomed to it. But for a lot of triathletes, I mean, the rest is almost as important as the training, and sleep is a big part of that. Is that something you are really sort of set on, that you've got to get X amount of hours in, or are you one of those guys who are lucky enough who can function on 3 or 4 hours and maybe a day or two and then get a decent night in?
No, I'm certainly not. I am very, very grumpy if I don't get sleep. The problem with my job is, though, that it may be broken. You know, I might get 7 or 8 hours of sleep, but I might sleep for an hour before I show in the evening for work. Then I might get 2 hours, a 2 hour nap in the hub when we're flying through in the middle of the night. And then I might sleep for, you know, 4 or 5 hours at the hotel before I wake up and go do my training and stuff. So although I might get all the, you know, that many hours of sleep when I'm traveling on the road like that, it'll just be kind of broken up. And I guess it's just something I've adapted to and been okay with. Justin, my buddy who coaches me, has always kind of been in bewilderment that I'm able to get in the amount of training I do with the unusualness of my schedule. Because also when I also teach in the training department, and when I'm home, 1 week, like for January, next week I'll be teaching from 6 p.m. till midnight, almost 5 days. And then the following week I'll be teaching from noon to 6. And then the following week I'll be teaching from 6 in the morning till noon most days. So, you know, those are actually harder than I think being on the road, because it's just constantly variable from day to day.
Yeah, Jay, I've got, I mean, just listening to this, I've got massive respect for you, because many years ago worked at a lot of overnight radio show slots, and they were also, it wasn't always the same time. And I think if it is the same time, it does make it easier because you can get into some sort of routine. But what you're talking about, sure. I mean, it's just all over the show. You wake up and you're not quite sure if you should be having breakfast or dinner. It's just, it's weird.
Yeah, for sure.
And I know how much of a toll that's taken on my body, and I wasn't training for triathlons back then, I can tell you that much. But massive respect. That's all I've got to say, because that is just phenomenal. But let's talk about Kona itself and the Big Island.
Sure.
What makes it so special, Jeff? I mean, you've been. What is the attraction to racing in Hawaii?
Well, I think the biggest thing is kind of the mystique of the race. It's just such a magical place. You know, when you go out there, you're just racing against the best. A lot of times, even if you go to a big Ironman race, there may be a handful of, if you're trying to qualify, there may be a half dozen or a dozen guys that you're really competing against. When you go out to the Big Island, if you're having, even if you've done really well at some Ironman race to qualify, if you just have a little bit of an off day, you are rapidly going backwards. I'm one of the faster cyclists out there. And when I went to Kona in 2014, I remember I felt a little off. I think I was just tired that year. It was my third Ironman that year. And not really feeling awesome. I wasn't riding slow by any means, but I definitely wasn't riding super fast. But I mean, how many people were passing me was incredible. You get to a point, if you're a really strong cyclist, you don't get used to being passed very often. And you go out to Kona and everyone is fast.
How humbling is that? So, I mean, you're training and you're racing in races where you're a big fish, and all of a sudden you get to Kona and it's not so much.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's very interesting for sure. I think any of the world championship type races, you get that. Now, Kona has its own, with the history of Kona, and I think the beauty of the island, but then also the qualification process has become so tedious and hard to qualify that it really is an accomplishment to get there. So I think there's a big part of that as well.
Let's talk about the biggest life lessons that Ironman has taught you over the years. What do you reckon it's taught you in the greater scheme of things?
Probably the biggest thing is just that what you can achieve if you are persistent and consistent and really put your mind to it. It may or may not be qualifying for Kona or whatnot, but if you put in the hard work, many times you can achieve what you want to do. And I think that applies in many areas of life, not just into triathlon.
Yeah, I love that. Persistent and consistent. Two simple words, but if you apply that in anything, you've got a pretty good chance of being successful.
Absolutely.
You show up and put up. That's what it boils down to. As far as your sort of achievements in the sport that you're most proud of?
This last season has been remarkable for me. The 2016 season was by far the best performances I had across pretty much all distances. And so I think it was a collection of performances over this previous season. It started with a race in October called the American Triple T, which is a grouping of, it's basically an Ironman spread out over 4 days, where I did very well and was extremely happy with the performance there. Then moving into the later season, I was prepping to go to the ITU Age Group World Championships in Cozumel. And I was had a lifetime performance there and actually earned a silver medal in the age group. About 8 weeks prior to Ironman Louisville, my wife actually said she would love to go back to Hawaii. So I started looking at some races, and I said, oh, it looks like Louisville's still open for this year. And she said, well, I think that would be a really good course for you. And I took that as she wanted me to sign up. So I think I kind of misread her, but lo and behold, I ended up doing that race, which was 3 weeks after Cozumel. And without a lot of really specific preparation, at least on the run, I was able to pull out a PR for the Iron Distance there and get my Kona qualification. So,
And she got a trip to Hawaii.
She did, yeah. So the whole family will be going next year. That's part of the fun of it too, I think, is you know, letting your support team, you know, relish in your victories as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's. I mean, on that season, what do you reckon it's been? Why do you think you had such a good season? Did you change anything? What do you attribute that to?
You know, I think it's been just a slow culmination over time. It's funny, I actually just pulled together all of my training numbers, which I've done every year since I've started. And although I didn't start training for Louisville until about 8 weeks out, and I didn't really put in the run volume specifically for an Ironman, this was my almost equal to the hours that I put in 2014 training for Kona and trying to qualify. So, you know, I think it was just being able to absorb that training over time, which if I tried to put in those hours 2 or 3 years into the sport, I'm sure I would have just completely blown apart and been broken. So I think it's really just a culmination of many years back to back of consistent training.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point, and I think one that many triathletes miss is they feel it's all about volume, and particularly early on in their career. And it's not. It's like you say, it's just bolting year after year of solid training. It's not necessarily doing tons of training, but it's being consistent and building on that foundation year after year, and that's what gets you the results.
Sure. And I think the last part was starting to maybe even, you know, I think there's a big difference between ego and confidence. And I think, you know, what I really started to develop was confidence that maybe I could perform if I put it all together. So, you know, being willing to go out there and really see what I could do on race day, with knowing that there is a small chance that it could all go very south quickly, you know. But you've got to lay it out there and see if it's going to work for you.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Sometimes you've got to risk it all to win it all. So, Jeff, I think that's a great point to leave it at. I look forward to getting you back on to talk a little bit about your swim, bike, run and also your nutrition. But I think we'll save that for another day. Thank you for your time today. Much appreciated.
Awesome, Brad. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for the Kona Edge.